and welcome. I'm Dennis Prout, Certified Financial Planner.
And I'm Shay Pataja, the co-host of
New Retirement Radio,
the podcast.
Investment advisory services offered through Capital Asset Advisory Services, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Genios Wealth Management Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Capital Asset Advisory Services. The topics discussed and the opinions given are for informational purposes only and are not intended as financial, tax, accounting, or legal advice, and are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their individual needs with an appropriate professional.
Good morning. Good morning, Ram. It is 2:25, February 25th, 2021. It's great to be here. I may seem a little disjointed because, boy, we have so much to talk about today. Thank you for joining us because we are talking with the tax man. Before we get to the tax man in-house, we have Ed Slott doing a webinar for our Prout Financial Design, and it is on proutfinancialdesign.com on the 16th of March. Tuesday, 6:30 to 8 p.m. It is a webinar we'll be doing through there, and I think you'll find it extremely helpful. He'll be talking about Roth conversions, current taxes, specifically to retirement accounts. And I have been recommending to everyone that's been coming in, boy, really avail yourself of that information. It should be fantastic. That is a great way of communicating and making it relatively interesting. He does almost as good a job as John Sluice, CPA, local star of Intrust CPAs. And, boy, John, we are glad to have you here today. Thanks so much for coming in this ultra-crazy busy time for you.
Thank you for inviting me. I actually get to get out and see the sun. And, you know, it's the one time of the month they open the door and let me out. So it's good. It's a win-win.
You start growing like one of those plants that, you know, don't have any sun. Yeah, you see them, you know, kind of wilting over. You bet. Well, it's great to have you. And in speaking of spring, it's amazing. I was taking a walk this morning. I'll only be brief about this. But it's crazy. All of a sudden, this window has shifted. And we're in the beginnings of spring. We're talking maple sap stuff going on, high 30s rather, low 40s.
I wouldn't pull my boat out yet.
No. It's a little cold. But we're at the beginnings here. So fun.
You can tell that you're not accountants because you're talking about outside weather. Mm-hmm. We don't get to see the outside
weather.
Even so
see
it's just
that.
It's
and
you know, it's
busy time of the year for you now?
Just slightly, yes. Yeah. So we are in the midst of it. This is the throes, and we're doing, you know, good 14, 16 hours a day every day. So it's fun, though. This is what we live. This is what we're here for. So
Super Bowl.
It is. We're the
Super Bowl for accounting.
Yep. That's right.
Here we go. So we have a lot to talk about today. Heidi is not joining us because of distancing we need to do here in the studio. But as an announcement, yesterday she passed her final of three tests for her retirement income certified professional. The designation provides comprehensive instruction on building integrated and comprehensive retirement financial plans. Good job, Heidi.
All right, Heidi.
And she was talking about studying for it, and it is a designation that was not an easy one to achieve. So if you do run into Heidi, please give her your congratulations. Good job. So we're talking about, we were going to talk about Kiplinger's 22 IRS audit red flags. And I wrote on there next to this is so yesterday. Now, there are a couple of things here we do want to cover, but we want to dive right in. You actually did your own outline, which was fantastic. We've reviewed this before the show, so we're not flying entirely on our own without direction. But you had several points to make in regards to these. You equated this to owning a Ferrari and continually driving over 100 miles an hour. The cops are going to come after you because you're endangering yourself and possibly others on the road. So the way that you think about this is try to stay closer to the speed limit, understanding the rules and regs, and possibly where you're going to get in trouble These are key points to talk about. Because if you understand where you're going to get in trouble, you can understand, okay, I need to be a bit more careful and or provide perhaps some more comprehensive documentation that what I did was entirely legal.
Correct. It's moral of the story there is if you own a red Ferrari, you're probably going to get a ticket. You own a minivan with soccer kids, you're probably okay.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you can't have the red Ferrari. Just enjoy it and go the 130.
So, yes.
Yeah, right. It is. It's a mind shift on the deductions. You know, when the IRS came out a couple years ago and simplified the standard deduction, they simplified it. They did it for you, but the IRS isn't a charitable organization. They did it for them as well, and because it made their life easier as well. And so if you simplify what people do, you simplify the audit process as well. So there's less things. Like a good example on that Kiplinger, the article, and that article is a good article, right? I don't want to say anything in there was not bad advice.
Sure.
But one of the age-old one talks about, well, watch your contribution rates. Don't deduct too much contributions compared to your income. That's a good one. It's sound advice. But when 85% of Americans don't itemize anymore, the IRS doesn't even care what you're deducting because you're taking the standard deduction. So they don't even see the contributions. Mm. And so that ratio goes away. That's effectively what they did when they got rid of that standard deduction. They said, you know what? Everyone plays the game and goes 5 miles per hour over. We're going to let you go 5 miles per over. That's okay. We're going to bump up the standard deduction. It's kind of like when on 131 here, when they changed the speed limit from 70 to 75, they kind of know everyone goes five over, so it's okay. That's okay. It's a mind shift, and then shifting away from those type of things into really looking, where is the IRS looking? What are they looking at? And that's where the important thing is to focus on.
And the first thing we want to discuss, and this one really surprised me here, is sales tax audits.
Yep.
Michigan sales tax audits. Who is that going to apply to?
It applies to more people than you think. And that's, you know, a little bit of, for the
that
listeners.
Was part of our discussion
before
that.
A little bit of preferences. Everyone assumes that you're talking about the tax man cometh, which is the IRS. Well, actually, there's also the state of Michigan, too, or other states. It's not just Michigan. It's any state that's out there. They get their revenue oftentimes from things not income tax-based, rather sales tax-based. And so where the states are looking are sales tax. And this applies to more than people think. A rental home, that has, like if you're doing a short-term rental up here and you're renting your lake cottage, that's subject to sales tax. If you're
make certain that you pay the sales tax on that. Obviously, you got to tell your tax preparer or you and do it yourself, and paying the appropriate sales tax given that revenue.
And VRBO or they can do it, but those are oftentimes you have to be aware of it, because if they don't, the state knows that and sees it. They're trolling those websites to see, and they're going after those that are on there. So that's one that's out
so
there.
So not just an IRS audit we're talking about the state of Michigan.
Correct.
Really
state
coming
of Michigan
after these, because it could be a significant source of revenue for them.
Local property assessors also doing that, watching this, the property tax, the homestead versus non-homestead. So a big red flag that I say that oftentimes people don't think about is it's thinking about the local and state as well. So
and it's not just rental property. You also mentioned construction companies.
The sales tax applies across all boards. So it's not, you know, when we talked about it, you mentioned right away, you're talking about retail stores.
And exactly.
I'm like, that's the general default. Well, it impacts more than people think. It's there's the rentals, there's construction companies. Is when do you do it? When are you the user versus the you're an artist. So if you're creating photography, is it digital photography versus a print photography? Because if you're selling something, does that apply? If you're a wedding planner now, if you're a florist, if you're all these different scenarios, are you providing a service versus a product? And it's getting into there, and they're really,
wow.
So there's a lot of strategy that you can play there, but it's also something where the IRS or the state of Michigan sees that. And so this is where they're going after.
All right.
Something to look for.
So thank you.
Construction company would charge sales tax when and to whom? What would be an example?
The general example for construction, this is general. A construction company is the user of the product. So they're going to use the wood, they're going to use the nails to make a product. So they consume it. So then the construction company buys it with sales tax and they don't charge it on the back end. But then now what about the cabinetry company that's selling the cabinet? Is that part of the house or part of the construction?
Wow.
Or what if you get custom trim versus off-the-shelf trim? Off-the-shelf trim is subject to sales tax. Custom trim is not. Hmm. So you go through all those different scenarios, and people assume, oh, it's clean cut. It's not, and the state knows that. So that's where the state is focusing on more so than
all right. So they know there are going to be a lot of faulty returns filed in regards to that, and that's an easy place for them to get some revenue.
Correct.
Given the time spent. Next is we had talked about incomes, particular income ranges being audited more than others. The stats are for those with incomes over $1 million, their audit rate's going to be about 2.5%. And you said almost as much as 2.5% is our audits for those with less than $25,000 in income.
Yep. People,
now, what is that all about?
It's not exactly the same percentage. It's a little different. But people assume, it's only the wealthy. Well, no, there's that bracket there. It's less than $25,000 or over $1 million. Where the less than $25,000 comes in is it's the earned income credit. It comes into it's a very lucrative tax credit that's out there, and people abuse it. And so the IRS knows it gets abused. And where this gets into is who's claiming the children. If you're divorced, is it you have joint custody? Which one of the parents gets to have it? Gets to have the dependent? And it's a big credit. This comes through the child tax credit, the earned income tax credits, and then it's a multiplier times the number of kids you have. And so this gets abused. And so the IRS knows that if they go for this, they can probably get some dollars back. They're getting backlash because they're saying, hey, why are you focusing on the lower income? But that is an area where they can focus on because they can get dollars back.
Well, so in this case, it might be where two different couples are claiming the same child deduction, same child as a deduction.
Correct. And the IRS would actually tell you, this is right from their website, that they feel that more than 50% of tax returns that include the earned income tax credit are incorrect.
Wow.
So that's they know there's a high error rate there, so that's where they're going to go after.
All right. Well, tell the audience, what is the earned income tax credit so they know?
The earned income tax credit, it's a tax credit benefited towards individuals that are working but are low income. And so the way they're trying to incentivize people to work, so you don't get it if you don't work, but you do get it if you work, but not too much. And so it could be upwards of $3,000 per child. And that's an ish, but in general, I mean, it can get fairly large. So you're talking $5,000 per child that you're having. So if you have three kids, that's a 15, potentially, it could be a very large tax credit that's out there.
And that's a tax credit that lowers your bill, or that's money that comes to you?
It is refundable. And so not only does it lower the tax you owe, it comes back. So you, in theory, could put $0 in and they give you dollars back out. And so it's real dollars that the IRS is talking about.
So it's not just a credit against your tax. It's extra money.
Right. Refundable tax credit. The same can be said for child tax credit and the American Opportunity Tax Credit. So that's the tuition one. So
yes.
It's whenever you're talking about children and tuition, and this fundamentally where they go, and so where the red flag is you can only do it once. There's your end
only
magic.
Only do what once? Sorry.
You can only claim the child once. There's only one child. And so if you have two people claiming him or her, that doesn't work. The IRS says, we'll give the dollars, but we don't want to have it double. So what they're looking for, and this gets in, I think, a great segue into the next topic, which is there is a decrease in audits because the IRS has fundamentally changed how they respond. And they don't treat correspondence or these auto checks that they're sending these letters out as audits. And so this is where I tell people, yes, you get the ability to e-file. The IRS looks at it as, nope, you have to e-file. And because of that, they can very nicely match things very easily. Well, guess what? Every child out there has a Social Security number. So the IRS very quickly can ping and say, okay, well, we have one tax return that's already claimed this dependent, this Social Security number. You're trying to do it. I'm going to spit out an auto letter. Nope, you don't get it. And so, yes, it could be seen as an audit, but no, it's more just correspondence where they're just mixing and matching based on numbers on a screen.
And within that correspondence, then, is the fact that they're saying, look, you've done this incorrectly. Here's our corrected, proposed correction, and here's how much more tax you're going to owe as a result of that correction.
Correct. Another one that I typically see within that is the premium tax credit. So if you went on the healthcare.gov, you got health insurance off of that, they gave you a premium tax credit, and you forgot to put that on your tax return, they're going to 100% guaranteed give you a notice because they're going to say, hey, The insurance company told us you got this. You didn't. We're mixing. We're matching. And here you go.
Well, in that case, then, they're giving you a greater deduction or a credit.
They're taking, in theory, they're going to take it back as well. So if you earned more than you said you were going
Okay. You're talking about if your earnings are too high to take advantage of that particular credit.
Right. Because in a sense, what they did is that with the premium tax credit is they gave you the money ahead of time. So it's a tax credit. Now you owe it back. And there's it. So yes, it's a red flag because it's, in a sense, it's just not there. So it's not a question of was it right or wrong or should I do it or shouldn't. It's you either have to have it or you don't have it. And so that's it's a fundamental shift.
That is a tough one. I've heard some literal horror stories from clients about this, not anticipating a significant rise in their own income during that year, haven't already scheduled or taken or gotten ready or in their process or they've already taken that credit. And then all of a sudden their income bumps up and they're not allowed to take that credit anymore. And their tax just balloons as a result.
Yep. And I try to get people there to shift their mindset of that. It's not that their tax went up. It's that they just had to pay their health insurance. And so now they realize it.
Well,
but you're just
well, it's a whole lot more money out of pocket. You bet.
Right.
We have a phone call.
Now let's go Dennis Prout from Prout Financial Design and John Sluice, CPA from Intrust CPA, and Joe in Williamsburg. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
I was wondering if you could clarify the tax due on the stimulus. And for businesses, the PPP, it seemed like it was taxable, then it wasn't taxable, then it was. I'm not sure where that ended. And the grants. And then could you also clarify, is the tax due April 15th, or did they move it, like last year, to July?
Okay, you got three questions in one there, so I'm going to hit the easy ones.
Hang on just a moment. Yep. Joe, thank you for asking that question. First of all, this is a great question. Yep. So let's hit all three. You got them in your head?
Yep, I've got them in my head.
Great.
So the tax deadline as of today, and I now unfortunately have to qualify that, it seems like, on a regular basis. As of today, the deadline is April 15th. They have not extended it. And I say that is for individuals. So business returns are still March 15th. So how I would answer that question, it is back to the normal deadlines that have been around now for a while. And so that is, there's not an extension on the deadline. So it's, for most individuals, it is April 15th. The next question you asked was on the stimulus check, or what is officially known as the Economic Impact Payment, or EIP. What that is technically an advanced tax credit. So just like we got done talking about the premium tax credit, the stimulus is an advanced 2020 tax credit. So to answer your question, it is not taxable because it is a tax credit. You have to report it on your 2020 tax return, both the first payment and the second payment, even if you received it in 2021, because it relates to the 2020 tax return. So I'm going to repeat that again. It's not taxable, but you have to put it on your return. So it's basically an in and an out. So think of it, if you're a couple and you got $2,400 for the first stimulus, you put $2,400 on the tax return, and then you say, well, I already got $2,400, so it's not due. So it's just in and then out.
Okay. The next part was the PPP program.
The third question, and this was one where we could talk for a very long time on it, so I'm going to do an asterisk and say this is my 30-second response. But in general, it was never going to be income. It was whether or not the deductions were deductible, and they have now come out and said it is deductible. So
they got, in essence, Congress got in a little spat with the IRS, and guess who won on that one? So the IRS was saying, because you're able to not declare this as income or it's forgiven dollars are, in essence, taxable. That was the first part of the argument. And then Congress came back and said, no, we're not going to allow you, the IRS, to qualify that as taxable income, even if that PPP loan is forgiven.
Yep. And so then the IRS came back and said, well, then fine, legislation, if you're going to say that the income is not taxable, the deductions aren't deductible. To which then now in the second stimulus, that's what they came out and said, okay, back again, spit back at the IRS, saying that, nope, it's not. So that's a long, fancy way of saying, and I'm asterisking this as much as I can, it's not taxable.
That's
the best way to look at it. It does not have a tax impact.
For most individuals, as long as you have the corresponding expenses.
Correct.
That's correct.
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay.
So, yes, I mean, I'm asterisking this as much as I possibly can, but at the general thing. So talk to your advisors absolutely about this. This is a very complicated topic, but in general, it's meant to be a wash.
Yeah. Now, this is a huge boon for most businesses who were thinking they were going to owe the tax on this one way or another and now have found out, no, we're not. So those amounts, non-taxable all the way through for most businesses. All right. So we're talking about audit triggers, if you will, from the IRS and newly attentive IRS possible so subjects that they're going to find more interesting.
Yeah, so there's all those articles out there on the internet that you can find on the triggers. Those are still there. Still look at them. But there are some that probably haven't caught up. One of which I see is virtual currency.
Yes.
So the IRS, on page one of the tax return asks, do you have virtual currency, yes or no? And if you do, you have to answer yes to that. I would tell you that is likely treated improperly on almost all returns that have it. And anyone that uses virtual currency is likely doing it incorrectly. That's a general statement.
Because if you've had a gain in that currency, then you have to declare it as income.
Correct. And it's capital gains is treated as a transaction every single time you move it. Just like, so it's people think of it as a currency, but it's not really. It's more think of it like a stock.
So for those who own Bitcoin and they've made, let's say, 20 times their money, how would that be taxed to them? Let's say they bought it, three years ago.
It's a capital gain, just like if you owed Ford or GM or a stock or general.
Or what if they haven't sold it yet?
Then nothing yet.
Then nothing.
But you still have to check yes on that, but it's not until you liquidate it. Okay. Where the risk really comes in is if you're, so under that scenario, you bought it to hold and you thought of it like an investment.
Sure.
That's what the IRS wants you to think of it. Mm-hmm. It's an investment, not currency. But if you use it to transact dollars, so every transaction, I'm going to buy my coffee in digital currency. I'm going to buy this service. I'm going to buy that. That's where when you hear like Square jumping on it and Tesla and those that are coming on, that they're going to receive payment. Well, in theory, every time you transact is, think of it like a stock transaction. So every time it's a reportable transaction. And the risk is why the IRS doesn't like it is because the digital currency does not report to the IRS. So going back to our earlier conversation, the IRS really doesn't care a lot about what you do because they know it. They get reported, they get the 1099s, they get the W-2s, they can figure it out themselves.
Sure.
With virtual currency, they don't know. So they can't tell. And so it's the big unknown of the new, scary, someone else is doing something, we don't have control of it. Therefore, they view that as a high risk, and they're going to likely, if you check that box, look for it. Mm-hmm. Same thing with,
All right.
Go ahead.
If you file electronically, they have that on their records then.
Correct.
Yeah.
Another one that I see a lot that people don't think about is foreign bank accounts.
The FinCEN form. What is that? 114. Yes.
So if you have foreign bank accounts or foreign assets, so think your cabin in Canada, or if you own some stock directly in, let's say, Royal Dutch Shell, and you don't own it through an exchange, but you own it directly.
You don't own it in a brokerage account where it's being reported.
Correct.
Yes.
So if you own directly stock or other. So if you own foreign assets, it's not necessarily that it's taxed. It may be. It may not be. But you still have to report it. And why is this an audit risk? It's back to the Panama Papers several years ago. But in general, the IRS does, again, wants to know information. They want to see what's happening. And because it's outside of their jurisdiction, they want you to tell. So it's a reporting requirement. And they have the ability to, any time that you don't report it, they can go back and get up to 50% of the value. So let's say you had $1 million in an investment account in maybe the Cayman Islands. It's not that it's taxed. You had to report that you had $1 million there. If you don't report it, that's a $500,000 penalty.
Jeez.
And so, again, if you look at IRS would go after it, that's where the dollars are. They're not going to get their dollars caring about who contributed a little bit more in deductions to Goodwill. Mm. They're going to get their dollars after going after these things. So So that is something.
Darling, I swear those clothes were worth $59, and they're saying it's worth $49. What's going on there?
Right. So, again, don't do that. But the IRS is going to focus on these, and this is it's an underreported thing. It's people oftentimes don't know it, and so there are thresholds, right? So you, in general, it's if you have less than $10,000 in a foreign account, it's okay. But where I see a pickup is Canadian properties, or if you're going down to visit in Mexico or other places, or if you have straight investments, maybe.
See, you have a Canadian a cabin in Canada. You, in essence, you need to report that on your tax return. And that's a foreign asset.
Yep. In the United States, if you're a U.S. citizen, the United States is a worldwide income. So you have to report no matter where you get and have assets to them.
All right. Thank you, John. We have a call.
We'll go to Maple City, and Amity is on the line. Hello, Amity.
Hi, guys.
Howdy. Hey, good morning.
But I'm glad there's a CPA to do taxes because that's Greek to me. It's a foreign language.
Yes.
My question is, I have a TD Ameritrade stock trading account on my computer. Say I have $10,000 in the account, and I buy a stock. It goes up 5 points, and I sell. Is that considered, and the money is not taken out, it's still left in TD Ameritrade, is that money considered taxable now as income?
What kind of an account is it in?
It's just a regular stock trading account.
Is it just your ownership or is it in your IRA?
That's my question. My ownership.
All right.
Yeah, so if it's your ownership and you sold that transaction or you actually had a transaction, then it is taxable to you. So if it's in an IRA, it's not. Or if it's just held but not sold, it is not. Then it's not taxable. But if you sell something, even if you don't pull it out of that account, you had a transaction, and then the IRS will treat that transaction as a taxable transaction.
Hmm. Okay, and then one other question. Say I bought a stock, say Johnson & Johnson, and it goes down, and I sell. Can I take a loss on that? And how soon can I take a loss?
So assuming the same facts and circumstances of the same account, so again, that's a taxable investment account, and in order to receive that loss, you actually, what's the IRS would say is realize that loss or recognize that loss. I'm sorry. So you can realize a loss, which means just because the stock goes up or down doesn't mean that you're going to pay taxes on it. It's
because
not
you didn't sell it.
Because you didn't sell it.
Selling is having recognized the loss then.
Correct. As soon as you sell or recognize that loss, that's when you can take it. Now, I want to get into it again, a little asterisk again, because I would love the idea and the ability at one point just to answer yes or no as an accountant. Wouldn't that be great?
It would be.
But to answer this question of when do you recognize that loss is if you have capital gains that you can offset it against, you can then offset it against those capital gains. Otherwise, you can take a loss up to $3,000 or down to $3,000 that you can do. So if you have
that's per year.
Per year.
And that can be carried forward. But if you have gains otherwise, then the loss that you can take is unlimited. So if you have gains, for instance, of $5,000 over here in another stock, and then you've taken a $5,000 loss on J&J, you can write off 100%.
That's correct. Okay? And what that's often common is called loss or gain harvesting. Yes. And so it's something, right? And you have to do it before the end of the year. So you can't do it now for 2020. So you have to do it by December 31st is when this has to happen. Is that you're going to go look at your portfolio and say, okay, I have some big gains. Maybe I want to sell some of the losses. And you actually have to have sold those losses to net them together. So it's loss harvesting.
Okay, and so that's considered short-term loss. Is there a long-term over 1 year holding it for longer than a year?
There is short-term loss and long-term losses, and it would follow consistent with what the gain would be. And you'd I'm not sure if I'm answering the question, but yes, they have different tax treatments.
Okay. Very good. Thanks, guys. Love listening to you.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate the call. Right. We have another phone call as well, Ron.
Yeah, thank you, Amity. We'll go to Wolverine, and Ralph is on the line. Hello, Ralph.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Morning, Ralph.
Had a question about backdoor Roth conversion.
Say that again.
Backdoor Roth conversion.
So what you're talking about is a non-deductible IRA contribution, which you turn around then and convert to a Roth. And I think I heard in the question, is it still available? Yes, the answer is it is still available. Well, nothing has changed.
Can I do it now and have it be taxable for 2020?
No.
No, because the conversion has to happen in 2020. You can contribute now and then convert in 2021. So the same rules apply as have they always have on those backdoor Roths, but they are still around. Yes.
Okay.
So a backdoor Roth, for everyone else listening, is a Roth that you use because you don't qualify on the income otherwise limited. You've got to have income of under $200,000 or so to do a regular Roth contribution, but there is no income limitation on a non-deductible IRA, which you can then turn around and convert then to the Roth. So that's why it's called a backdoor Roth. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the phone call. All right, so John Sluice, thank you so much again, CPA, for joining us. Your phone number for those who might want to have, or might rather have questions in regards to their own personal tax situations is, if you would.
Phone number at the office here is 231-935-1590, 231-935-1590.
And you're right in Traverse City, right off of Woodmere, correct?
Just south of the library.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. Go to the library, pick up your book on taxes, and then go see John. There you are. Now, the next part is more focus now. You see not only virtual currency having more focus from the IRS, but some other areas here. Let's talk about those.
Yeah, so one that I see, and this is not necessarily a new one per se, but one that I see abused quite a bit is S corporations without wages. And so we talk about red flags and the ability for the IRS to come in and easily check because they like easy. So they have spots right on their tax returns where they can hone right in and see something. And right on the front of a Schedule S corporation, so 1120S, which is what many small businesses here in northern Michigan or just small business in general use as an S corporation. And they don't pay, oftentimes they will not pay a wage to the owner. It's called compensation to
shareholders. Will they just pay dividends or what will they
just
pay?
They try to just pay dividends because it's less taxes. And this is not getting into income taxes. This is getting into self-employment taxes or Social Security and Medicare.
So dividends are taxed generally at 15% max and regular wages at whatever their tax bracket is.
Yeah, and I'll get a little bit detailed here. So an S-Corp technically doesn't have dividend, it has distributions, and is treated a little bit different. But it's ordinary income, think of it like a dividend, I guess is the best way to think of it, in the sense that by not taking a wage, the business owner is not subjecting themselves to Social Security and Medicare. So if
those taxes,
taxes that on that particular thing. So the example I'd give you, let's say you made as a business owner, that's an S corp, you made $100,000. If the IRS had their way, it's all waged $100,000. If I and the business owner had our way, it'd be zero. Because then it's all that distribution or dividend. So there's nothing to subject to the self-employment tax. Generally, you have to have what's called a reasonable compensation. And so you've got to be somewhere in the middle, right? The point here is I can't tell you the number of times that I'll take over a client and I'll see on the 1120S, zero for compensation. That is just saying, please, please, please pick me to the IRS that is just the unbelievable biggest red flag I've seen out there. And it's just, I shake my head, is even if you put a dollar, and that's not right, but yes, at least if you put a number, it's better than just building a big old fat goose egg on there, because this is just asking to be audited.
Speeding into a Ferrari.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, you're probably doing 140 around a curve, maybe.
Yeah.
Like that.
So it just goes without saying, if you're being a hog in that sort of situation, you're going to get slaughtered.
Yep.
When it comes down to it. And, you know, what that does in essence, it just, as you just said, it makes them focus on what you're trying to do, which is not reality. If that's the case, we are actually working in the business. You're spending hours per week or per month in that business, and then not relating the wage.
Correct. And this gets into, I'm going to step back on all of these items, is think like the IRS does think like a business owner to some extent, right? They're looking at it and say, why would they spend labor dollars to go after and look at things? It's when it's going to make sense. So again, are they going to go after that contribution for the $50? Probably not. Are they going to go after the FinCEN that's $500,000? Yes. Are they going to use their AI automated systems to match and look for these little ratios that are out there? Absolutely. Because it can spend less time on it and just focus on the auto things and just hone right in on those, again, what are red flags? And that is one of those.
All right. Next stuff. self-prepared tax returns.
You brought that up. I didn't, so I'm not trying to be self-serving when I say this. But interesting enough, a lot of people assume that when you're going to come to a CPA or an EA or anything, that you're going to actually save on taxes. And while I like to believe that's the case, and in long term I hope it is, oftentimes the first year or two, it's not the case because we bring up things that people may have been missing. Oh, you forgot to include this as income. You forgot to do this. Or there's a, I'm signing my name to the tax return when I sign it. And so I'm going to be
saying, there's some accountability there.
There's accountability. And so I'm asking that question to make sure it's right. Whereas if you do it yourself, you could tend to go, I'll go a little bit further, or I'll just do this, or ignorance. And unfortunately, ignorance is not bliss when it comes to this. It's not an excuse.
Well, ignorance is not an excuse.
Correct, that too.
Unfortunately.
So they do. They will look, and they see right on the return whether it's self-prepared or not. And so they will look at those, and those do have a higher rate of audit than prepared.
It's good to know. All right, we have a phone call, Ron.
We go to Charlevoix, Michigan. Al is on the line. Good morning, Al.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Yep. My missus received some money from her mother's estate, and we wanted to put it into a Roth or her traditional IRA. We made the choice to open the Roth and put the $7,000 that we can do. I later learned that you have to do that with income and not inherited money. Is that true?
Potentially, yes. I mean, again, there's lots of asterisks all over the place, but what you're referring to, the limitation, in order to contribute to an IRA, whether Roth or traditional, is you have to have earned income.
So that's the next question. Sir, do you have earned income?
Yes. So,
hey, hang on. No. Did he say he had earned income? That's what I'm asking
does.
You.
I do Social Security.
Okay.
Okay.
So if she has earned income, there is the potential. So you can use inherited dollars to maximize the fact that you also have earned income and use the IRA. But if you don't have the earned income, then just having the IRA or the inheritance.
Well, she could do a spousal IRA for you as well.
Yep.
So she could do her own Roth IRA as long as she has enough earned income to cover the full $14,000 that she could theoretically put within her Roth IRA, $7,000 for 2020, and $7,000 for your IRA in 2020.
So you're saying it's all the same cash, two different piles. If you're going to put $7,000 into an IRA, make sure it's from your earned income pile, not your inherited pile.
Right. You can use, in essence, your inherited pile to pay it, but it is as a result of having earned income. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So you have to have that much in earned income. Is that the adjusted gross or?
It's earned income. So, like, for example, you mentioned that you had Social Security. That may or may not be in your AGI or your adjusted gross income, but that is not earned income. And so it would come down to the earned income. So if she only had $3,000 of earned income, you could only put in $3,000 into an IRA.
Understood. Yeah. One last question then. Can you open a Roth for 2021, and as they allow you to do designated for 2020?
Yes.
Well, up until April 15th, you can make a contribution for last year.
So his question was, can you still, even if you're opening it in 2021, can you count it for 2020? And the answer in that case is yes. You can now go and open up an account and make it effective for 2020.
You guys are the greatest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
Glad
we answered your questions.
All right, we had one other one that called in, just wants to know why a red flag is bad if I'm not doing anything wrong, I guess.
That's a great question, and I tell people that is a great question, and a red flag isn't bad, right? So this gets into if you're going to drive a red Ferrari, it's not a bad thing. There's still red Ferraris out there. Just know that it's drawing attention to it. So driving a red Ferrari at 75 miles per hour on the highway, it's okay. Sure. And that's all right. So just know it and so feel comfortable. Yeah. So I'll have lots of discussion with my clients that says, hey, this is a risk. Like a good example of this would be, I had someone that sold a business. They made $3 million one particular year. We said, you know what? This is the year that you're going to want to make a contribution because you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck. Well, because of that, the ratios on that contribution went through the roof. Well, that's okay. We just have to make sure it's documented. So to answer his question is, just because it's a red flag doesn't mean it's bad. Just be aware that you might have to respond. And that's gets fundamentally back to my overall point of that fundamental shift is, don't view the IRS as a bad thing. They're just working in the confines of trying to do what's right. In fact, think of them like a somewhat like a police officer, in that they're, if you're driving the minivan, they're not there to get you. They're there to help you overall. Yes. They're there to look at the individual driving 130 miles per hour in the red Ferrari.
And know that you may well get a letter from the IRS, and you'll need to provide the proof. So make certain that you have the proof if you're mm-hmm. outside the lines and in the averages. So that's just part of the game that we all get to play.
Yes, it is.
You bet. How are we on time here, Ron?
We can do, say, another minute or two before we wrap up.
Okay. I've got lots and lots of pages of this, which is fantastic, and I love these topics. And really, I mean, to draw it all together is just be smart. Don't go greedy. So the IRS has the position that they're going to outlive you, right? There's nothing certain in life except for death and taxes. They'll let you take a deduction because they know at the end of the day they're going to get the income. But if you get greedy and you make up fake deductions or you go too far, that's the red flag. So just be smart about it. That it's, you're not winning anything over when you do these things. So, yes, don't tip the government either. You don't have to go over, but just be smart about how you're doing it. It's just timing, Dave.
So it reminds me of that old story from Zig Ziglar, who said, you know, I looked at all these businesses, and he said, I asked everyone. He said, I looked at 30 different ones in order to purchase, and they were all averaging about $1,000 away from what the actual numbers were. So he said, in each case, I'd always ask him, all right, where are your real numbers? Mm-hmm. And he said, in the end, was it really worth all the angst and worry that that caused, having to try to skew those numbers or fudge those numbers? In the end, he said, of course it wasn't.
Yep. Spend your time doing the right deductions versus the just the fun.
Absolutely. Ones. Using those to the maximum yep. that you're allowed
yep.
under the law.
Under the law.
You betcha.
Be honest. But
thanks for having us.
Have some good advice. Because even if you're honest, ignorance is no excuse, right?
It isn't. Yeah. Either way, yeah. you bet.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find us online at proutfinancialdesign.com. That's P-R-O-U-T, financialdesign.com. Also, you'll be able to find us on iTunes and SoundCloud.